Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Today's special guest is Richard Riley. You know him from numerous television shows and movies, including The West Wing and The Fugitive. He now appears in Madeline's. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars.
Hello, Mr. Riley. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
It's definitely a pleasure to talk with you, sir. You've been in so many TV shows and movies that I've watched. It's my honor to speak with you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, definitely my pleasure. I always start off with a question of inspiration. So what inspired you to become an actor, and who were your earliest influences?
Oh, golly. It was purely by accident. I was just trying to get out of college. I couldn't afford to stay there any longer. And a friend of mine said, you know, you can take all the credits you need in speech and drama in one semester. So I did. And then I got out. And the guys who were running the department felt bad that I was leaving in the middle of the year, and so they got me a job, a teaching assistantship at the University of Minnesota to go my MFA. I said, what the hell? If they're going to pay for it, I'll do it. And then it just sort of snowballed little by little. My advisor at Minnesota got me a job at the Meadowbrook Theater in Michigan, and one of the guys I worked with there got me work at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And at some point I finally said, well, look, I'll just do this until somebody knocks on my door and says, okay, get out. You've had your time. And so far I've been lucky. Nobody's haven't heard that knock yet.
So you were a teacher at the University of Minnesota for acting?
Yeah, I got an MFA in acting and directing there.
So what did teaching acting teach you about acting?
Well, I actually learned an awful, I learned a lot more as when I was teaching acting than when I was taking acting classes. When you have to explain to someone what the process is, it makes you much more aware of it than when you're just trying to take it in for a credit or a grade or something.
So when you... because you had the pleasure of being both the student and the teacher. What did you take from as a student that you had to utilize as a teacher? Or what did you learn as a student that you thought to yourself, I don't want to be a teacher like this. I don't want to teach this type of acting or this kind of acting. I want to do it this way.
I had a lot of great teachers over the years. When I was at the University of Minnesota, we had a lot of people from the Guthrie that came over and taught classes, and they were wonderful. And then I got to go over and work at the Guthrie for a bit at the end of my time there, and then went back several years later and was a member of the company. But when I went to other places, Los Angeles, for instance, and I would sit in on classes that people would say, oh, you ought to check out this class. I was sort of appalled that people were taking money for what they were giving to the students. And that's when I decided I neither wanted to teach or be a student again. I would learn everything that I could on the set or on stage in rehearsal. And I found that that was the case, that you learn much more doing than taking classes.
Well, from what I've read, it sounds like you did just about everything on the stage. I heard that you worked a lot as a stage manager. You helped build the sets for and costumes on stage. I mean, was it intentional strategy?
Well, it was partly intentional. I mean, I had to do that for my semester at Notre Dame. I had to take all of these classes that I knew nothing about. So I literally lived in the theater for a semester. And then the job that they got me at the University of Minnesota was running the scene shop. And so I was there 40 hours a week, making sure people weren't cutting off their fingers. And that was, and I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that aspect of it. And as it happened, there was a an MFA student in playwriting who had a play that he had written called Bang Bang, You're Dead. This would have been in like 1969 or 70. And it was about a Korean War vet who had essentially PTSD and was being treated at Great Lakes Naval Hospital. And he had become a total alcoholic and hated being at the hospital and hated everybody there, and particularly hated the nurse that was giving him a hard time. And the difference between that and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is that my character kills the nurse.
Much better version.
But it turned out to be a very good play. And because it was this guy's MFA project, all of the professors came. So, and that was the first time most of them had seen me do any acting at Minnesota. And I began to get all of these offers. Would you audition for this play? Would you audition for that play? And I thought, well, if I'm spending all this time in the scene shop, why not, you know, find out a little more about the acting part of it? And then I eventually found that I enjoyed that much more than measuring and cutting and cutting twice and measuring twice and cutting lots. But I was good enough at it that they pushed me toward that direction my last year and a half there.
So is there a potential alternate path where you would have become either a stage director, costume designer, or set designer?
I don't think so, only because like when I had to do a drawings for a costume class in grad school, and they were terrible. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to figure out what was meant by that. I'm not bad in doing the actual screwing and cutting and nailing, but designing, I don't have the imagination that will take me to the next step on that. I enjoyed directing. I did a lot of directing early on, theater directing. And when I came out here, sometimes people said, well, are you interested in directing? And it just, I said, no, there's much too much technical part of it that I don't understand. And I don't feel comfortable, I feel comfortable working with actors. I don't feel comfortable trying to figure out where the camera's supposed to be and when it's supposed to move. And, you tell me and I will get where I'm supposed to be, but I, don't make me figure that out myself.
So does it help having done all those things? I mean, being a set designer and a stage manager and costume designer, do those insights help you become a better actor or just maybe a better person on stage when working with you?
No, I think it does. I think it really does help you because you understand more what the director is trying to get at. You understand, why a door is here in the set and how far you can open it. And you understand the kind of organization it takes to do a play or to shoot a film which I learned as a stage manager. And you get a real insight. You see things, to see things from all different sides, I think really does help you as an actor.
So as someone who has tons of theater experience and tons of television experience and tons of film experience, I mean, I think when I went on the IDMB pro page, I scrolled down your history of film, your filmography. That's one long ass list. I mean, I think it was like 10 minutes long going through your entire list. So did you do this when you went to the film set and the TV set? Did you do the same things that you did for the theater set? Did you try doing like the stage, whatever they do, like whatever the correlation is between stage, costume, and design and film and TV?
Well, I was fortunate. The first film job I had was in Rooster Cogburn and the Lady. I was at the Oregon State Shakespeare Festival, and they were shooting it up in Grants Pass. And somebody said, "Oh, you ought to contact these people. They're looking for a bunch of actors." So I did, and they hired me to be an extra, but also to stand in for Richard Jordan, who was one of the villains. And so I got to be on the set and see what the process was, which was all foreign to me. I had no idea, you know, what it took and how many people it took. And I mean, even things like everybody has to walk just this one path because we don't want to we don't want to bend down the grass that you know there for the shot. And then one of the first things I did, they said, okay, we're going to do a stunt. The stunt man is going to be kicked in the face over the fire, and then roll down and roll off this about 4 foot drop. And then it looked like he falls off into the river below. And they said, would you mind being one of the people that catch him? And I said, no, not at all. So I was kind of crouched down behind this thing. And I watched the guy practice, and he practiced taking the hit, and he walked down the path that he felt he was going to roll, and and checked it for any rocks or stones or twigs or whatever, and cleared that out of the way. And then they said, okay. And so I hid down and heard the action go on, and noticed that he rolled off about 5 or 6 feet away from where I was ready to catch him.
Yeah.
And then the director yelled cut, and I was right there, so I could see it. And the stunt coordinator came up to him and said, okay, we've got it. If you want to do it again, you know, we can do it again, but we've got it. It's in the camera. And then by that time, the director came down and said, oh my God, are you okay? Blah, blah, blah. And the stunt coordinator said, you know, it's okay. We have it. I mean, you know, if you want to do a safety, we can do it again, but we have it. And they said, oh, okay, let's move on. And I went to the stunt guy and I said, I'm just curious why, you know, you did all the other stunt practice, but you never practiced rolling down. And, you know, and that extra adrenaline, and it pushed you a little further and you roll a little. And he said, I'm not going to do any stunt, no matter how safe or simple it seems, when the camera's not rolling. You know, so I practiced as much as I needed to start it. And then, you know, as long as the camera catches it, if I get hurt, I get hurt. But, you know, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to practice and get hurt. And, you know, that's just crazy. And that was an interesting, you know, one of the many interesting things I learned on my weekend on the set there.
That's an amazing dedication to one's craft, to not only be willing to hurt yourself, but making sure you're on camera when you do, because you don't want to do it for like absolutely no reason.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are other things. I mean, there's like, John Wayne was an incredible guy, but you know, they had a double for him that looked exactly like him. He just had a high squeaky voice, so he couldn't do any of the lines. So he would do everything up through the medium shots. And then Wayne would come in and do all the close-ups and all the lines, and it was great. When Katharine Hepburn showed up, she showed up about the same time I did, because she was in London doing some movie. And she wanted to do everything. She wanted to camp out. She wanted to take one of the, they were moving equipment up and down the Rogue River on these boats. And the day before, they had flipped one of them, and one of the Teamsters had broke his leg, and she wanted to go rafting on the Rogue. And they said, no, you can't do that. And she wanted to drive the buckboard, and they said, please, you know, we've got somebody that'll do that. We can't afford to have you get hurt. But the thing was, is that at the same time, because she was so excited about being part of this project and so interested in filming everything, Wayne, who had done like the last 10 or 11 movies with the same crew, started, you know, being there all the time. And not only being just a perfect gentleman, but being a wonderful actor, you know, being there for offset stage lines, for, you know, everything that could possibly do it. And you could see the whole crew get excited about how you know, about how this was like, they said, this is like the old John Wayne, you know, and for a while now he's been just showing up and then leaving. At the same time, his contract broke him at noon on Friday, and they would drive him out to the ocean where he had his boat docked, and he'd spend the weekend there, and they bring him back on Monday. But even because everybody was working the rest of that day, he put out this, he arranged for his big spread to be out there at the end of the day, that everybody could, you know, could have something to eat and drink and talk about. And it was great.
That's awesome. What is it like as an actor and a future actor to be around that level of passion for the craft? Is it contagious? Is that something that you want to bring when you're on a film set or TV set or theater?
Oh, absolutely, it's contagious. And again, like I said, you could see it. You could see Wayne suddenly change, you know, within a day from just doing his job to really being excited working with Katharine Hepburn.
That sounds awesome. It must have been a major treat to have been around those two legends, because they are. Like, I mean, it's sort of like being around almost like a Babe Ruth in baseball. You know, you're around the guy.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. Well, what did you else did you learn about the craft of acting from watching these legends perform?
You learn that first off, it's all in the eyes. I mean, the only shots that mattered were the close-ups, and it doesn't mean that you don't work. And all the way through, and for every shot. But the thing is that it's you don't have to. The difference, I guess, that I was going to say between stage and film and TV is that you don't have to project everything, your character and your emotions and everything. It's just you have to really feel them and make them a true part of who you are and who your character is.
I mean, it really is a kind of, it, like I said, it's impressive looking at your career. On stage, I read that you're in The Execution of Justice, which was one play, and you're also in The Iceman Cometh. So
yeah.
Having all that experience on TV sets and movie sets and theater, do you prefer one over the other?
It's interesting. I think as an actor, and most actors probably would agree to this, that the actor's medium is theater, because you have a time to rehearse and really learn who the character is, what the situation is, working with the people that you're going to be working with, and so that you feel comfortable by the time they add the audience in 2 or 3 weeks, and you really are kind of rolling with it. And once the show opens, it's the actor's show. The director leaves, and it's just the actors that are performing it, and their relationship with the audience and with the text. In film, you're providing the director and the editor with the best possible options, and in the end, they're going to be telling the story. With what you have given them.
Yeah.
You're doing the same. Your process is the same. It really doesn't change. But somebody else in the end is telling the story. Where on stage, you're telling the story every night. Mm. And in TV, it's really the writers. The first TV show I did was My Two Dads. And I was doing a scene with Dakin Matthews and Eric Christmas. And we realized that among the three of us, we had like 125 years of experience doing comedies. And yet, if we set up a joke in a scene and the audience didn't respond, the producers and writers didn't care. They weren't going to let us try and figure it out, along with the director, try and figure it out or try and make it better. They immediately rewrote it.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's all about the writing. And again, you're trying to provide the best examples of their writing to make work what they envisioned in their minds.
Now, are you still performing on stage, or are you are you full TV and movies now?
I like to perform on stage whenever I can. Just before everything shut, I mean, literally, we closed the show at the Geffen on the on a Sunday, and Monday they shut down all the theaters in Los Angeles. And what we were doing, I was doing a play based on Key Largo that Andy Garcia had co-written and was playing the lead in. And he had a really interesting take on it. He felt that the lead is not the villain, and he wrote it from that point of view, and I thought it really worked, and we had a great time running it. And you know, there was talk of extending it, but it was Christmas, and so they couldn't extend it. They would have to close it and reopen it, and they couldn't afford that. And there was talk of bringing it to New York, and then all the theaters closed. So two and a half years ago was the last time I was on stage. But I try and do plays on a regular basis when I can. I was in November. I was back in Indiana doing a 1 week workshop of a new play. And that was, you know, it's always exciting to be on stage.
What is the key to your success?
Well, I think, you know, in the end, I think it's like they teach in improvisation. You say yes to everything. Yes. And I think there's maybe five or six things that I've said no to in my career. Sometimes at first you don't quite see, you know, what you're going to learn or what you're going to gain from doing this particular role or doing this particular piece of work. But you get, as you work on it, you get more and more excited. I mean, I think I'm like a lot of actors in that in preparing for an audition, you know, maybe at first you're going, oh yeah, I'm not really too interested in doing this. But by the time you're ready to go in and do the audition, you want that role because you've discovered what the key is to it, what it is that you think you want, and what you think the writers and producers and directors want from that character. And you know, sometimes it can be just a small role, but it really changes everything at that point. So yeah, I think it's just saying yes.
Does the fire ever die out for you by acting? Like, was there a point where we were just like, all right, this is a job now? You know, did that point ever hit you? How did you overcome it?
It hasn't yet, and I hope it never does. I'm the oldest of seven kids, and now 2 years ago, my youngest sibling retired. And every time one of them retires, you know, I get the, so when are you going to retire? I said, from what? I couldn't imagine a better life in terms of doing what I want to do. Mm. I mean, it's like they say, if you're doing what you want, you're never working. And I think that's true. Right now I'm learning lines for four different projects, and a couple of them have been postponed. You know, they keep changing when they're going to shoot. But each time I run the lines for that character, I go, this is great. You know, it's got to happen. I hope it happens. And in fact, I'm heading down to Galveston in a couple of weeks to do this movie that this poor guy, you know, is funding out of his pocket. He's been shooting it since 2019. You know, whenever he can. You know, whenever things open up enough that he can bring in the people to, you know, to do another scene.
That's crazy. I mean, and also let's learn that many lines at once. I mean, how do you keep that all in your head? Four different lines for four different projects.
Well, this was the thing that really blew my mind when I was when I got offered the first time I got offered the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and they were in those days, and they may still, I don't know, I haven't been there for a while. They did six plays in rec, three in the afternoon, three in the evening, and they changed every day. And so you would sometimes be rehearsing three plays to open. And then once those three plays open, you start rehearsing a fourth play. And they explained that to me when they hired me. And I said, and a lot of this, and most of them are Shakespeare. And they went, yeah. I said, I don't know if I can do that. and they explained, they said, this, your mind is a muscle. And the more you exercise it, the better it gets. And of course, I didn't believe them, but I went out to give it a shot. And sure enough, by the time we opened the first three plays, not only did I have all the lines for all three plays, but they were different. They were different characters. I knew, and I felt no problem with starting rehearsing for a fourth character. It really is. The more you do it, and that I think that was a hard thing with COVID, with the shutting down, is that a lot of people stopped. That process and like the rest of their muscles, they got weaker keeping up that memorization process.
That's really cool. I like the idea that acting makes you smarter. That's such a good lesson to have.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I want to talk about another, one of my favorite projects that you were in. Because I am a massive fan of The West Wing, and you played The West Wing.
Oh yes,
where you played Officer Jack Sloan. And like I said, I am such a huge West Wing nerd. I probably have rewatched each episode 8, 9, 10 times minimum. And honestly, what the episode you were in, it was fantastic as you played Jack Sloan. What is it like working on an Aaron Sorkin set?
Well, he wasn't there at the time for that part of the season, but that was okay. But the interesting thing was that I've been trying to get on the West Wing for years and auditioned several times and it just didn't work out. And when this cop came up, suddenly everything sort of fell in place. And so they said, okay, we're going to have you come in to do this cop. And John Spencer had been an old friend of mine. We had done Execution of Justice together in New York, and I knew him pretty well. And so I had, the night before I was supposed to shoot, he was doing a play down at the Taper. So I went down, and it was in preview. So I went down to see it, and I stopped and saw John afterwards. And he says, yeah, I told them you were coming, that they better be on there. On their best behavior, should bring in their A game, because they're gonna deal with the real actor. I said, Jesus, John. but then I showed up on the set and it's two scenes essentially, and so I'm working the first scene and Chris Misiani is directing it, and it's a wonderful scene, and we're having a great time out. But he's not sure. He said, don't be so angry about it. Be more hurt. I went, okay. And so we did it that way. He says, yeah. And then he said, I'm not going to be able to direct the second scene. And I said, okay. He says, yeah, I've got to go and direct a scene from another episode. We're losing an actor after tonight. And so I promised I'd go out and direct that scene. Oh, it was Stalker Channing. And so I said, okay. And so he said, but Tommy Schlamme said he directed, if that's okay. I said, yeah, of course it's okay. And so, his process and his direction was entirely different. So I had no idea what this was going to be like when I finally saw it. The writing is so good for Snard. Mm. But these two guys had been they had shot between them, hundreds of episodes, and they were, it looked like seamless, and it was wonderful. And it was just a great, I mean, it was a great, great experience to be on that set with those people. And, you know, and people that I knew that were on the show stopped in and said, how's it going? How you doing? And it was a real family there. I mean, it was amazing.
That's awesome. I mean, the one thing that I think Sorkin's projects are best known for is the dialogue. It's a very,
yes,
like a picture style of dialogue. It's not Shakespearean, but a certain rhythm to it that's unlike any other show. Was it difficult, absolutely, for you to fall into that rhythm?
It was, well, I was sort of prepared for it, but yeah, it was the thing that was strongest in my mind was making sure that I kept up that pace and that rhythm that they had. And of course, you know, the people I was working with were long experienced at it. So it was, you know, there, you didn't have time to listen and process and get to your line. It had to boom, 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 you know, which is great.
So did the dialogue or delivering the dialogue that supersede the acting? In other words, did it dictate the type of acting you had to do because of the speed of and rhythm of the speech?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, again, that's very much like Shakespeare. The dialogue really does help you do what the character, a well written piece like this was, and like many Shakespeare plays are, you know, it if you do it correctly. If you do it the way it was written, you automatically are in character and are dealing with it. I mean, I think that was the thing with Chris is that it's written, you know, he's responding so quickly, but no, I mean, I had to jump to this guy. He was running. And I guess he felt that the pace that I was doing it was making it sound more angry than hurt, and I think that added a whole element to it that to be able to do it at that pace and yet feel oh my God, I couldn't, you know, why are you doing this to me here? You know, I didn't do anything. He's the guy that bad guy, not me.
So, I mean, and one of the people you got to act with is another person who I'm a huge fan of, Allison Janney. What was act against? Amazing.
Yeah, she is just incredible. I've loved her work forever.
Yeah.
Again, both on stage and on film and TV.
I mean, I think another great thing that you've done, the acting that you did in with Jackson was so amazing. Like I said, you didn't have that many scenes, but in the few scenes that you had, you created a fully realized character, in my opinion. I mean,
oh, thank you.
No, you're very welcome. I mean, you felt different. I mean, he felt real. You felt like he had layers of character, depth of character. And you, like I said, only had a few scenes. So how did you approach it to make sure you gave it all that in such a small amount of time?
Well, again, the text really does help, and in fact is primary in terms of presenting the character, and the text was there. It was in delivering the text, you there are all of these elements, and then if you want to add something, again, like Chris did, you know, it's easy because you have been doing it, and now all you're doing is making a slight adjustment. You're not changing, you know, everything to do it. And this is often a problem with sometimes with younger actors, but who want to make the text their own in a way, and so they ad lib or they change words, try to find something that's a little less, more or less that fits in their mouths easier, and it changes everything. And so if you really are true to the text, I think it helps.
And like I said, I mean, West Wing, I think had aired maybe 20 something years ago. Do you still get recognized as officers? Because for me, like I said, you're always going to be Officer Sloan.
I occasionally get recognized from Western, because like you, so many people have, you know, have made that a repetitive viewing thing. But it was funny when I was back in New York, I was doing The Man Who Had All the Luck, and I noticed I was taking the subway, I was on the street all the time, and I noticed that people were kind of looking at me, but nobody bothers you in New York. So I did sort of a unscientific survey while I was there to try and figure out why people were looking at me. And I found out that it was about, I was doing Grounded for Life was on the air at that time. So about 15 or 20% of the people, especially the younger kids, recognized me as Grandpa from Grounded for Life. Then Office Space had just come out. I would say 40% of the people, you know, recognized me as Thomas Markowski from Office Space. And then there was like a good solid 10% who recognized me from whatever was on cheap cable late that night. So, you know, it could be anything. It could be Joe Dirt or, you know, whatever.
Right.
And then there were another good 10% thought I was the guy from at the bodega, or was their sixth grade teacher, or you know, somebody from the neighborhood. So yeah, I sort of have the face that people think they know who I am, and sometimes they can place where it is that they know me from, and sometimes not.
That's awesome. Well, you're recently have been in a movie called Madelines as Rory Devonshire.
Yes.
So how do you get involved in Madelines?
Well, it was very interesting. Again, it was one of those occasions where my agents got the script, and they said, you know, would I be interested in reading for it? And it's a crazy movie, and I just loved it, reading the script. And it's not a major role, but it's a guy that sort of forces them into the problems that they find themselves in. And as I read it, I said, I really want to do this. And then I realized there's only three of us in the movie, essentially. Yeah. I worked with Perry after that on Hatchet, and I've known him from General Hospital, and he actually was at my agency, so I think that's probably how the script got to me. And I shot in essentially two locations, the backyard of this house and the garage, and then around Christmas time we went down for 2 days to this beautiful loft downtown LA, and it was all decorated for Christmas because it was Christmas. But we had to be very, very quiet in the hallways and doing the stuff there. But the thing was is that making this character Rory is a lot like me. I'm totally a Luddite. I barely can make my iPad work, as you can probably see. He sees the possibility of making some money if they can figure out how to do this time travel thing. Mm. So he's offering them, you know, an opportunity to do this. And he's found two really smart people who should be able to do it. But they won't tell him anything. And part of it is that they know he won't understand anyway. But part of it is when things go wrong, they have to distract him from what is happening, you know, in their lab. I love it. I think it's just a really fun, exciting thing. And Jason was incredible as, you know, both as the co-writer and the director. I mean, he really made it easy. in something like that, you have to be almost tunnel vision. You can only be aware of what you know, or what you can be aware of, and everything else is happening around you. And that's, you know, again, that's the director. That's what he's dealing with. And Brea, of course, co-wrote it as well. So she had sort of the inside of it, but she had to, because she was playing 3,600 Madelines.
I mean, it was really a smart movie. I mean, when I decided to watch it, I didn't know what to expect. I was like, all right, you know, there's only three people in this movie. You know, what can this possibly be for an hour and a half for only these three people? And I was watching, I'm like, this is really smart shit. I mean, it is very clever. It has some very interesting moral questions, especially about the self. You know, because once again, who was the real Madeline? The original Madeline, the second Madeline? Do they each have a responsibility or have the right to survive, to live? You know, and you know, it was a very smart movie, and I thought it was so just well done.
I agree, and you know, and again, things like the design element of it. I mean, they did it on no budget, and yet, you know, you can believe that that's their lab, and that they're able to do what they're doing there. Hmm. And I love the humor that is all the way through it. I mean, just when things get really, I mean, at one point, somebody's getting murdered every day. Yeah. And at the same time, you can see the humorous aspect of it.
Well, I think, I mean, it's after a while, the characters do it so casually, you know, I kind of was curious. With those characters, I mean, at some point, does the murder not have any meaning? Does it not have any meaning because they're just so used, you know, desensitized, or because the other Madelines don't count? I mean, it was a really fascinating thing. And then, not giving anything away, later on, when they introduce some more Madelines, it gets even more fascinating philosophically, just story wise. It was incredibly smart.
Oh, I know. And the ending is just, you know, you. For a while there, you're wondering, you know, what's happening, and then Perry's character looks like he's dying, and then all of a sudden, you pull away, and the world is entirely different from what you thought it was.
Mm. And I mean, I think it was genius, and I think another interesting thing I thought was your character of Rory. Now, you played Rory in a kind of an empathetic way. Was he always going to be played that way? Was that a decision you made? Because, I mean, he could easily have been played to be, you know, like the badass, you know, the bad boss, you know, I told you to do this, but you played it very empathetically. Once again, how did that come about?
Well, I can't tell you if there was an idea of playing him differently, but when we started rehearsing and shooting it, I started playing it that way, and I guess Jason liked that, so we continued with that aspect of it. So it just seems that if he doesn't have the knowledge to have that kind of badass power.
So when you're in a movie like Madelines that has a lot of interesting moral dilemmas and questions and philosophical issues, things of that nature, is that something you take home with you and you like ruminate over for a while? Or, you know, is it something that's just, you know, a cool movie and you kind of just leave it on the set?
Well, I think Rory tends to, not blame himself for the mistakes that his employees are making. Mm. And a lot of the time he doesn't know what they have done. So when it's finally kind of they try and tell him, he can't take that all in. I don't think he knows what they're saying, and so he just says, go away.
So where can our listeners find Madelines to watch it?
I'm sorry?
Where can our listeners find Madelines?
That's a good question. Like I said, I'm a Luddite, so I have no idea. I know it's streaming on several platforms, but I don't know where. And I wish I could help you with that.
Well, just for listeners, Amazon Prime is a good one to find it on. I'll just edit that part out. But They get, our listeners can find it on Amazon Prime for, you can rent it for $4.99 or buy it for $7.99, and you might as well buy it because you're going to watch probably more than once.
Thank you very much, because I don't have any of those, and so I wouldn't know what they are.
Absolutely no worries. Okay, and finally, what can you tell our listeners what projects you're working on next?
Well, I'm on my way, like I said, to Galveston to do hopefully the final scene of Old Man Jackson, which is about a guy who thinks he's dying and is trying to find a way to get someone to take over his business, which he inherited from his father. And he doesn't trust his wife and he has no children. So, and between his fear of dying and his hypochondria, he goes to all these places to try and feel better about himself and get better and eventually just figure out what he's going to do with his life. And it is a comedy. and I play Father Donovan in it, he wanders into my church and I try and help him out, and eventually I get frustrated with him and kick him out of the church. And it seems that's what everybody's response becomes to at one point or another. I just finished doing a mini series for Apple Plus TV, which is based on a graphic novel called Surfer Girls, about two 14-year-old surfer girls who also get involved in the supernatural. And it was really fun doing. And so I have no idea when it's going to show up, but if you keep your eye on Apple Plus TV, you'll eventually find it. And I play a hermit, a lighthouse keeper whose lighthouse is leaning, and they don't quite explain why.
That's cool. Well, Mr. Real, I hope when these movies come out, you come back on the show. It was definitely a pleasure to talk with you.
I'd love to. Thank you.
Encyclopedia of film, TV, and stage knowledge. So you're always welcome to come back.